to order the Joint Judiciary Committee meeting. It's about 1 o'clock on Monday, February 14th. Judiciary Chairman Senator French, please introduce your members that are here.
Thank you, Judiciary Chairman Representative Gatto. Let me just first thank you for setting up this meeting. I think it was a great idea to save everyone time, save time for the Attorney General, do a joint meeting. It's good to see you and our House colleagues here. I'll begin by introducing Senator Coghill is here, the Vice Chairman of the Committee, Senator Wilikowski is here, Senator Pasquin is here, myself, Senator French. Thank you.
And for the House, we have Representative Keller, we have Representative Thompson, and myself. We have some other members that will probably show up as we move on. First, the housekeeping. If you own one of these things, silence them. we also have some other people who are here as aides. Monica Genesek, Special Assistant to the Attorney General. Dave Blaisdell, Administrative Services Director. And we're free to ask questions of them. So, do we call you acting? Do we call you?
Designee. Huh?
Designee. Attorney General Burns is here to give us an update on past, pending, and future legislative issues. Representative Pruitt has now arrived to join us. Sir, it's your time.
Chairman, it's a privilege to be appearing before the Joint Committee this afternoon to present an overview of the Department of Law. For your convenience, and in order to facilitate the presentation, I provided a hard copy of the slideshow that we'll be going through. The intent was to do two slides per side, double side. I don't know if that message got through, but I was hoping to save a few pages. At any rate, prior to beginning the presentation, I'd like to take a few brief minutes to introduce myself. As you are aware, I'm the Attorney General designee. It's not a position that I sought, but one that I'm actually very humble and honored to be fulfilling. As a lifelong Alaskan, I share with each of you a sincere desire to meaningfully contribute to the betterment of the state of Alaska and a commitment to the state. My roots, like many of yours, run deep in Alaska. I grew up first in Nome, where I gained great appreciation and awareness for life in rural Alaska, and where I have the fortunate opportunity to spend a lot of time in unique places such as King Island and Diomede. From Nome, my family migrated to Fairbanks in approximately 1970, and I can tell you, as a kid coming from Nome, Fairbanks was a megalopolis. I rode the escalator in JCPenney's many an hour. I resided in Fairbanks ever since, although I spent a great deal of my summers working with the Department of Fish and Game through high school, college, and law school. Spent a lot of that time in western Alaska. Got to visit a number of the villages in the communities there, and also spent a good deal of time in Prince William Sound. I also spent a great deal of time with my dad commercial fishing. As I've told many of you when we've met, he called it bonding. I called it bondage, but it's a different perspective. I'm a graduate of the University of Alaska and Puget Sound Law School. For the past 25 years, I've been an attorney in private practice in Fairbanks, specializing predominantly in commercial law, business transactions, and insurance defense work. I'm married to an incredibly patient and understanding woman, Christy, and together we have two children. Two daughters. During the past 8 weeks since my appointment, not only have I spent time meeting with members of the Department of Law in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, getting to know the issues, I also spent a great deal of time in Nome, Bethel, and twice visited Barrow to get a better understanding of those communities. I've met with law enforcement officials, Department of Law personnel, the judges, met with the youth court facilities, also the women's shelters. And the point being, or the emphasis of that, was to get a better understanding of how the Department of Law can better meet those needs.
Just a moment. We have been joined by Representative Grunberg. And my question for you is, you mentioned you had an extremely patient spouse.
Yes.
It is Valentine's Day. We'd like to know if you managed to...
we're really getting into some private personal issues, aren't
we? Let's skip that question.
I took care of sending that text early this morning. Thank you. My objective as Attorney General is very simple. It is to uphold the Constitution, the laws of this great state, and to do so with dignity, integrity, and consistent with my ethical obligations as an attorney. I will dispense with the introductions other than to introduce Vanna White here, who will be presenting the overview. The mission of the Department of Law is to prosecute crimes and to provide legal services to the state government for the protection and benefit of Alaska citizens. We do that through three divisions: the Criminal Division, the Civil Division, and Administrative Services Division. The Criminal Division has 13 offices, the Civil Division 14 different sections. Our core services are divided into four areas: protecting the safety and financial well-being of Alaskans, fostering conditions for responsible development of our natural resources, protecting the fiscal integrity of the state, and promoting good governance. I think it's always important to provide a few key statistics as we before we get into the accomplishments of the Department of Law and the Department of Law. As of fiscal year 2011, there are 284 attorneys that are providing the services to the Department of Law. It is our hope that with the approval of the budget in FY12 that we will add two more attorneys. That will bring us up to 286. The two attorneys, one will be a district attorney in Kotzebue, and the other will be a public records attorney in Anchorage, having to deal with the burgeoning records request. The fiscal year 12 budget request by core services, you can see there that 62% of the budget is spent protecting Alaskans. And that's done predominantly through the Criminal Division, Child Protection Services, Commercial and Fair Business, and Environmental Law. So 62% of our budget is focused on protecting Alaskans. You can see a pie chart that reflects the same thing. The economic opportunity resource development is approximately 9% of the total budget. Return on investment, to the extent that a law firm is responsible for return on investment, this slide is an incredibly telling slide. This is for the full year, the fiscal year 2010. It covers the entire year. You can see that our budget was $85.4 million. The return on investment was almost $7 per. Now, when you focus on the Civil Division, which is actually where the vast majority of the, almost all of the collection efforts are, you can see that the budget there was $48.9 million, and the return was almost 12 to 1. The recovery in fiscal year 10 was $576 million. To date, fiscal year 11, we are in excess of $108 million in recovery.
Mr. Chairman.
Question?
Thank you. Two questions. Number one, does that include the $500 million Mercer recovery? And number two, is that all in-house costs, or is that including outside counsel costs?
Through the chair, the answer to the first is yes. Fiscal year 10 did include there was $500 million for Mercer, and the answer to the second is that includes in-house and out. So when our budget reflects the totality of the expenses, both in-house and outside counsel.
Just to follow up, if I could, Mr. Chair, how much did we pay in attorney's fees for the $500 million recovery to the outside firm?
I'm sorry, through the chair, I'm not certain of what the answer was. I believe that was on a contingency arrangement. I don't know what the share of that was, though. I can certainly provide that information.
Would that be included in the costs? My understanding was like $100 million or $200 million, something like that.
I'm not sure what the actual cost was, so I can certainly provide that to you.
All right, thank you.
But just for clarity, when we talked about awards and collections, 576, 500 is the Mercer collection.
Correct.
And we're going to, of course, show some of that up in the costs also. So really, except for this one-time payment, typically your collections are closer to 76.
Well, this year, I'm not sure the average by year. There's a slide later on that will reflect a 10-year recovery by the Department of through the oil and gas, and I think the recovery there is almost $1.9 billion. So it fluctuates. So already this year we've recovered $108 million. None of that being Mercer.
Thank you.
Although the presentation today focuses predominantly on the civil division, I think it's important to very quickly touch base on the criminal division because it does consist of the vast majority of our budget. We have 13 district attorney offices throughout the state of Alaska, as well as the Office of Special Prosecutions, which handles cold cases, Medicare, or Medicaid, welfare, PFD, insurance workers, that sort of thing, appeals, and also rural prosecution unit, which will go up and assist in rural prosecutions when either they lack staff or expertise on certain issues. The next slide would be the map of Alaska, and you can see precisely the locations of the prosecutors throughout the state of Alaska. 13 different locations, also the numbers of attorneys in each of the locations.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Would you flip the back the previous slide, please? Thank you. You have 7 in Bethel and only 4 in the entire 2nd Judicial District?
Yes.
Why is that? Is Bethel that heavy a crime area compared to the rest of the state, really?
Seems I don't have the statistics, but that seems to be the... And maybe Mr. Sabodny is in a position to respond. I don't know if for all those, Mr. Sabodny, Rick Sabodny is the Deputy Attorney General, handles the criminal side of it.
And Mr. Sabodny, if you want to bring a chair up and
I
then...
I was hoping not to.
Well, it's a request.
Just one question. And if I could, through the chairs, Bethel is a major source of criminal cases. For example, the last time I checked, Bethel had one more sexual assault than the entire Anchorage area. So basically the number of sexual assaults in Anchorage and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta are the same. If you think about it, that area is the size of the state of Oregon. So there are a lot of crimes and a lot of violent crimes being committed in that area.
May I follow up, please?
Please.
If the members would look and they'd see there are as many DAs in Bethel as there are in entire southeast Alaska. Mm-hmm. And that, at some point, at least this representative would be interested in knowing, and maybe at some point, I don't know, a meeting or a briefing or something, what's going on in that region of the state. I mean, that is just, I had no idea if this is reflective of the criminal activity out there. Something is going on, and I'd like to know more about it, and I don't want to take our time now. But that is of concern to me.
Could we just, if you know, what the population, that it's not just Bethel population, but the population it serves?
Mr. Chairman, that gets me. I'm not sure. The population of Southeast is probably about 50,000, and you know, I don't know the population of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. I do know there are 47 villages that we service out of Bethel. So that, you know, that's another issue. I mean, when you have 3 kind of hubs in Southeast, and you may have to go from Juneau to Hoonah, you know, Juneau office has maybe about 5 places they have to go to compared to 47 out of Bethel.
Thank you.
Yes. Through the chair, it is an issue that we clearly recognize, and it's a matter that I personally intend to spend a significant amount of time addressing. So,
I just hope that you can be kept informed.
Representative Gruenberg. Thank you.
Sure. The next slide reflects in 2010, the calendar year statistics, number of screened felonies, number of felony cases prosecuted, same thing regarding misdemeanors, those screened and prosecuted. Now let's transition into the civil division. The slide of Alaska reflects that we have seven offices. There are a number of attorneys in each of those offices, predominantly in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. Those offices handle the issues statewide. The first core mission is protecting Alaskans, and I want to focus on the civil division of that. And the civil division, through child protection, commercial and fair business, human services, regulatory affairs and public advocacy, environmental, labor, and state affairs, those are the six sections that we classify within the department as handling that core function. The one that we are probably all very familiar with is what we call the child protection attorneys are handling the China cases, child in need of aid. This is an interesting statistic in that there are 3,000 child in need of aid cases yearly, 2,000 cases ongoing at any time. So many of those are obviously rolling from year to year. Our child protection attorneys handle a caseload of 113 cases per attorney, which exceeds the national average of 100 cases. Our attorneys are obviously very busy, but as this next slide will reflect, very successful. This is a slide that I'm particularly proud of, this statistic, because it reflects that there on all 11 Supreme Court appeals, there were of Superior Court orders terminating parental rights, they were all affirmed. And what that tells you is that OCS, the Office of Child Services, is doing a phenomenal job in making the determination as to which cases warrant moving forward. And when the Supreme Court affirms all 11 of those cases, it's a tremendous statistic. The consumer, the commercial and fair business section handles a lot of the consumer complaints. Consumer protection handled a number of settlements. The Publishers Clearing House, DirecTV, Dan and Yogurt, average wholesale price, which is drug litigation. Many of you may be aware of that was where the Alaska's Medicaid program was being overcharged. And so far, Alaska has recovered $13 million. As a result of those overcharges. Publishers Clearing House, that was a $300,000 settlement. Dan and Yogurt, $425,000 settlement. That's all associated with false advertising. The other one at the bottom, the Juno Jewelers, false advertising, 40-75% off sales. The only problem was that those are constant prices. The prices don't change. That sign still stays up. So that was the genesis of that lawsuit. The next slide reflects something that historically has been an issue for the legislature and in rural communities as well as urban, and that is, you know, the price of gas. The State of Alaska Department of Law did a fuel price study. There was also a fuel price study done by University of Alaska Anchorage, the Institute of Social and Economic Research, and the reality is that it's a matter of it's not price fixing, it's simply a matter of the market. We continue to monitor that. The State of Alaska, through the Department of Law, is certainly not in a position of regulating prices, but we continue to monitor it to ensure that there is no price fixing. So this was a study that was undertaken because of concerns that the legislature had expressed as to fuel prices. Many of you are aware of the recent decision out of Florida on the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. We continue to advise DHSS and Division of Insurance and Retirement Benefits on how that act, if constitutional, will affect the State of Alaska. The current status of that litigation, as many of you are aware, is that the Florida court determined that the aspects of the act were unconstitutional, and that the act, the remaining portions which were the court found valid, from the court's perspective, could not be severed, and therefore the court threw the entirety of the act out as being unconstitutional. The expectations, Department of Justice will appeal that, and because there are, I believe, 13 or 14 similar cases that are winnowing their way through courts throughout the nation, that the Supreme Court will ultimately have to weigh in on that issue.
Yeah, I have a question too, which begs the question: is the state investing any funds in implementing part of the act?
I'm not sure the answer to that question. Here.
Senator French.
Thank you. When the decision of the Florida District Court was announced, the governor said in one of his statements he would be turning to you and asking you what the legal status of the federal law was in the face of that ruling. What's your advice to him on that?
Well, I can certainly tell you the legal status of the law. The Florida case is the one case that Alaska intervened in. That Florida decision found that the act was unconstitutional. That remains the binding law as relates to Alaska at this juncture. Certainly the expectation is the Department of Justice will move it forward. I know that I think all the governors that were impacted by that decision sent a letter to the federal administration urging the Obama administration to move forward with an appeal and appeal it, if possible, directly to the Supreme Court, as it clearly is an issue that needs to be addressed, and it won't find resolution without getting up to the Supreme Court.
Would you just describe for the people watching the term non-severability?
Effectively, what the Supreme Court, the court in Florida determined is that the health care mandate was so intricately tied to the other aspects of the act that you were not able to pull apart one aspect and leave the remaining portion of the act valid, and so not so much valid, but able to be enforced. And so the court wasn't able to make the determination as to whether or not that act could survive independent of the healthcare mandate. And so the court basically said, throughout all of the testimony and the briefing by the federal parties, they kept on emphasizing how intimately related the mandate was. And so the court basically said, I'm sorry, I can't differentiate, therefore I can't sever it, and the whole thing has to be thrown out.
Senator French.
Thank you. Mr. Burns, the federal judge in Florida didn't issue an injunction, did he, against further application of the law?
He did not.
And yet your advice to the governor is that this decision of the federal judge in Florida is binding on us. Does that mean that we're breaking the law if we continue to abide by it?
Well, it is the decision of the decision of the Florida court that the act itself is unconstitutional, and so as far as that court determined, our position is that that act being unconstitutional, we're not obligated to follow the act.
So the other governors who are party to that suit, Florida governor as an example, those governors taking steps to make their state ready for the Affordable Care Act, they're breaking the law?
No, not at all. I mean, each of the states are taking different steps to evaluate. And I think that, Governor Parnell himself, my understanding is his position is that, it does, the issue does need to be evaluated. How it is evaluated remains to be seen, and whether it's through an act such as yours, a bill such as yours is being proposed, or if the act is ultimately determined to be constitutional, whether we follow that route remains to be seen.
I'm just a little unclear as to the binding effect of that court's ruling on the state of Alaska.
The court's determination is it's unconstitutional. That is the law as relates to the state of Alaska, its position vis-a-vis that act.
So just if I can follow up, I want to make sure I understand this. So you're saying that the state of Alaska is relieved from all of its obligations under this federal law in the absence of an injunction because of this decision in Florida?
There's no obligation. I mean, certainly the state of Alaska could proceed forward if the state of Alaska chose to do so, all right, electing to move forward and evaluate independently whether to pursue an exchange of that nature, right? Whether it's on its own or following the federal mandate, assuming that the federal mandate down the road is held constitutional. There's no obligation on the state of Alaska to follow the federal mandate.
Thank you.
Sir.
If indeed the judge determined the law unconstitutional, is issuing an injunction necessary, or is there an implied or consent or so that allows anyone operating under the PPACA Act to make their own decision as to whether they want to move forward or not?
That's exactly right.
So it is implied. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill, one more thing. We have been joined by Representative Lynn. Senator Coghill?
Maybe one of the questions about why an injunction or why not an injunction might have to do with some of the timelines. Is it the timeline issue of the individual mandate? I think it was 2013 or 14. Is that one of the reasons why an injunction was not made? I'm just trying to think through if it was found unconstitutional, why further action wasn't done, and if the timeline was one of the issues.
I don't know. The court didn't specifically indicate as to why there was no injunction, whether the timelines were relevant to it. But certainly there are a number of timelines that do apply. There's 213, 214. And so, the court emphasized, and the parties recognized the importance of having this decision to the Supreme Court on an expedited basis because of the potential cost.
One other question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill?
Is there a reason it was not filed under an original jurisdiction question rather than at the federal courts that they fell into?
I don't know the answer to that.
Senator French?
Yeah, and this isn't supposed to be a hearing on this subject, and so I'll let us move on. But there is an important deadline coming up for not only all the individual consumers, the consumers of private health insurance in Alaska who can now put their children on their policies up until age 26 because of the federal law that I guess under your interpretation they'd be now free to reverse themselves and stop doing that because the law has been declared unconstitutional down there in Florida. But I'm very concerned about state employees who are like myself, who has a child in college, 22, on my insurance now because of the college exception, who will graduate in May, and I'd like to keep him on my insurance. I'll be eligible to do so as a state employee in August when the governor decided to make that decision effective on state insurance. I hope the governor doesn't change his mind in the face of this decision in Florida. I hope he doesn't decide it's elective on him as to whether or not to follow federal law. And I hope you'll advise him that in the absence of an injunction, I think the law is still on the books. I think in the absence of an injunction, we have to continue to abide by that federal law. But that's
through the chair. My understanding is that the governor is evaluating precisely what you just indicated. Sir?
In the interest of my understanding of the law in covering children 26, if you're a retired state employee, that 26 rule does not apply. It reverts back to 23. Do you know if I'm correct in that?
I couldn't tell you.
I've read that and heard it.
That's correct.
But apparently it is correct. So for those of you who suddenly retire from the state, that 26-year-old allowance is reduced to 23. And then the state of Alaska refused $1 million from the federal government in order to implement the mandate, and that was another thing. And I think we were one of two states or one of one states that declined the money. So if that's true, we had apparently made our decision earlier than the decision from the Florida court.
Yeah, I'm not, through the chair, I'm not aware of any
thank you.
Decline.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. I've gotten emails, communications from constituents who are concerned about some of the provisions, rather support some of the provisions, and do you know if the governor is planning or do you plan on advocating to the governor to propose legislation that would, for instance, ban discrimination against people with pre-existing disabilities
another provision of the PPACA was the prohibition on lifetime monetary limits and the provision to provide care for children up to the age of 26. Do you know if the governor is, since he's declined to work under the federal law, proposing any legislation to fix those things at the state level, or do you propose advocating that he do so?
I've had no conversation with the governor relative to that, and I don't know what the governor's position is on that.
And is it not your job, essentially, to not take a position, but simply to defend the state's position?
One of my responsibilities is to give advice, not simply to defend a state's position. If the state's position is unconstitutional or in violation of the statutes, my responsibility is not to defend the state's position, but to the extent that it is constitutional and consistent with the statutory parameters, I would defend the state's position.
Thank you. Continue.
Moving forward with regards to the protecting Alaskans, you can see the one of the other divisions or sections, the Human Services sections, and that handles the Department of Health and Social Services. We are in positions of defending DHSS in various situations involving foster care, public assistance, and the like. We also represent DHSS in Medicaid overpayments. Most recently, the independent auditor indicated that there was excessive charges, and we were able to recover $1.9 million, and that's a the Medicaid attorney is one of those that more than pays for himself in the audit process. The next slide reflects the environmental section of the Department of Law protecting Alaskans. In this situation, the state of Alaska filed a litigation against BP Exploration of Alaska, and this suit, as you may recall, relates to the losses stemming from the 2006 Prudhoe Bay pipeline shutdown, which is due to corrosion. One of the slides there, the slide in the bottom, reflects the amount of materials, we call it sludge, that had built up in the pipeline, and that prevents the pipeline from being able to be thoroughly evaluated when they do these the different testing on it to make certain that there's no corrosion. The only way that you eliminate that is through pigging it. The environmental section also handled the cruise ship initiative, as this body was well aware of. HB 134 regulated the wastewater discharge, allows cruise ship owners and operators until 2016 to fully comply with the new water quality standards. And that was and the result of that was through a successful campaign and lawsuit settlement, the movement to 2016 is now allows the cruise ships to continue coming to the state. Many of you are familiar with RAPA. It's the one of my functions as Attorney General is to advocate the public's interest regarding regulated utility matters before the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. The SINCSA, as we call it, is the for those of you in the Anchorage area. That was a gas storage facility that was fairly contentious at the time, but the recognition is that you have to have supply in order to meet demand, and so the state of Alaska through Department of Law was instrumental in the process of that evaluation, and RCA has approved that facility, and the decision was just issued January 31st. We also, through RAPA, look at the billings of the various utilities. NSTAR, where there was a billing error that was undercovered, and the result of that was $5.7 million in refunds. The Department of Law, through RAPA, is monitoring those refunds to make certain that they are paid to eligible customers. And as all of you are well aware of the Sexual Assault Domestic Violence Initiative, the Department of Law played a key role in helping develop that 10-year initiative. We have been instrumental in collaborating with agencies, nonprofits to support that initiative, doing public service announcements, and sponsoring pro bono summits, which I will continue to be very involved with. The second core function of the Department of Law is what we call fostering responsible development. That's done through four sections: the oil and gas, transportation, environmental, and natural resources. Point Thompson litigation, again, as many of you are well aware, Point Thompson litigation, we are continuing to pursue resolution with Exxon. We're very optimistic that that resolution can be achieved. Those discussions are ongoing. We continue to devise the Department of Transportation, public facilities, and we defend the state on various building projects. This is just a few of those that have been listed. Those of most note: Goose Creek, Juneau Access Road, Connect Line Crossing. Environmental section is, as many of you are aware of, the Kensington Mine issue came up last year. We prevailed in the United States Supreme Court, which allowed Kensington Mine to open. The result of that was 200 workers. There were 300 workers during the construction, 200 workers during production. 85% of those are Alaska hire, is my understanding. That's an instance where the state and the federal government, working in tandem together, reached a very successful resolution litigation. The next slide is another similar one. The Red Dog Mine.
Just to go back to Kensington, just for the record, 25 or 30 members of this building were out there yesterday being introduced to all the various operations. And one thing we did learn is it cost them $450 million just to put the mine in place. And then they generate somewhere around $1 billion a year before expenses. In other words, the product is sold for about $1 billion. So it's a great resource for the state because it also has the 200 permanent hires and who go back and forth. Just wanted to add that comment. Thank you.
Yeah, and I know that they are very appreciative of the efforts. We, the Department of Law, have received many, many letters of appreciation. The next is another example of a similar positive result, and that's the Red Dog Mine. EPA had originally withdrew key components of water and pollution discharge permitting. We assisted DEC in promulgating new regulations that allowed the mine to continue operations, and jobs were secured. The direct jobs involved there were 516 direct jobs that continue to be operating. And the ancillary jobs, indirect, are 2,800 jobs when you account for both direct and indirect. I found this to be very interesting side note, how Red Dog Mine got its name. And this is a comment from Chief Justice John Roberts. Red Dog got its mine because a pilot was regularly flying over the area, spotted unusual colors on the earth. He suspected there were mineral deposits and alerted surveyors, and his Red Dog was his flying companion. So that's how simply how Red Dog got its name. Oil, gas, and mining is another section within the department that fosters responsible development. They defended Outer Continental Shelf leases and court challenges, lease number 193. Also defended Interior in the approval of Shell's Beaufort and Chukchi Sea OCS exploration permits in lawsuits in federal court. This is another example of where the state and the feds are working in tandem for positive results. Likewise, we challenged the Department of Law challenged Interior's purported imposition of a moratorium on development in Alaska and the OCS. As many of you will recall, that that decision just recently came out, and the court dismissed the lawsuit based on the fact that the federal government unequivocally asserted in filings that there was no moratorium. It was unfortunate that we even had to file the litigation. We did, and the upshot of it was an unequivocal assertion by the federal government that there is no moratorium. Tongass Timber, another situation is the state partners with the U.S. Forest Service and management of Tongass National Forest. We've supported Tongass exemptions from U.S. Our USFS roadless rules. We've supported Federal Service authorization of the logjam sale. Again, the logjam sale, if successful, will preserve a number of jobs. This is another example of the state working in tandem with the federal government. This is an issue of that has been in the news significantly of late, the Endangered Species Act. We are seeking to develop a comprehensive strategy in dealing with these issues. There are a number of challenges regarding unwarranted listings. We're challenging unwarranted critical habitat designations, because the fact is that these listings and these designations have significant effect on transportation, resource development, sporting and subsistence fishing and hunting. Endangered Species Act, this is just listing petitions. These are petitions that have been recently sought through the ESA. You can see a number of those. Visible ones are, and vocal, are the polar bears, the beluga whales in Cook Inlet. Both of those have significant impacts to the state of Alaska. Pacific walrus, that was a listing that just came out. It was an indication that the listing was warranted but precluded from the standpoint that the federal government didn't have the resources to pursue the listing further. Critical habitat designation is, all of you are aware, the polar bear designation encompasses 187,000 square miles of Alaska. It has been designated as critical habitat for polar bears. In addition to the listings, there are a number of lawsuits and appeals that are pending. The polar bear, beluga whales, Steller sea lions, humpback whales, and ribbon seal. The Steller sea lion one is an interesting one from the standpoint that this is there's both a western and an eastern stock. The eastern stock, the state of Alaska has been petitioning for a delisting of it based on the population densities. That looks like a very promising feat in the future. The western continues to be a bone of contention from the standpoint that the federal government has listed that, and the effect of that was a closure of the fishing in the area that has a significant socioeconomic impact on ADAC. The states, as you are aware, the state of Alaska filed a notice of intent to sue, challenging the 187 square miles of critical habitat. This is what's interesting also is that all groups in the area, not simply the state, but Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, North Slope Borough, as well as industry, have joined in similar listings. They have all filed separate notices of intent to sue. That leads us to the FY11 budget expenditures. You can see that the totality of all of the ESA listings, the litigation, the appeals, we have budgeted $1,396,000 for FY11 in dealing with those issues. And the budget is roughly the same for FY12. It may be a little more depending on what additional listings come forward, and that's part of the problem. Is there's no ability to identify what's on the horizon with regards to the listings. Oil and gas has also assisted DNR, DEC, in requesting prompt federal review of challenges to petroleum to exploration in the NPR, NPRA, the Clean Water Act wetlands fill permit for CD5 project. As many of you are aware, that was project, the permit was denied by the Corps. It's been remanded to the Corps for further evaluation. Again, this was an instance where all of the stakeholders joined in support of that project, and yet the Corps denied deny the permit. It's been, as I said, been remanded, and we're optimistic that the Corps will act promptly in an evaluation of that the permit on remand. Likewise, we advise DNR on response to BLM wilderness and wildlands designation. Again, this is an issue that most recently came up. Secretary Salazar has ordered the evaluation of 72 million acres of federal land in Alaska for wilderness characteristics. The potential of that is to create a de facto wilderness without congressional oversight. This affects permitting, rights-of-way determinations, and the like. In addition to BLM, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is evaluating their revisions to their plans on Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which, again, would have comprehensive conservation plan impacts, the potential of a designation of a wilderness status to Congress. We assist DEC in a request we continue to assist DEC in requesting EPA action on Shell's Clean Air Act permit. That has been delayed, and you know the consequences of that. Shell has indicated that they have basically lost the 2011 season, and so no action will occur in 2011. This is an instance, I think the papers well reflected, the state's federal congressional delegation was unanimous in denouncing the EPA's action in this instance. Clean Water Act, another instance, the Environmental and Natural Resource section is involved. This is the Clean Water Act, the 404C designation. There are a number of different aspects of the Clean Water Act, 404B, 404Q, and 404C. 404C is an instance where the EPA can exercise veto authority where there's been an ARNI designation. An aquatic resource of national importance. And so when it gets elevated to an ARNI, the EPA has the ability to exercise a veto power because typically what has happened is historically the EPA has deferred to the Corps to do permit evaluations, and very rarely have they stepped in to preempt that or to veto. But it certainly, that is, as we are aware in the, as the Pebble Mine issue percolates, that the EPA has stepped in and said that they are at least going to do an evaluation. They have not indicated that they are going to preempt or veto, but at this juncture they are doing an evaluation. NUNAMPTA is a litigation that was, I believe it was a two-week trial regarding the permitting of what we called the permitting of land and water use. These were temporary permits to allow exploration in various areas. You get a temporary permit, you're able to do core sampling. That's been challenged as being unconstitutional, and the plaintiffs have sought more public, that they want these temporary permits to be publicly noticed and actual best interest findings to be established before permits are issued, which means that on each permit you have to do an evaluation as to whether or not the issuance of even this temporary permit for a core drilling to evaluate whether or not there's sufficient minerals to even think about doing a development has to first occur. Also, defending Alaska's fisheries management, this is one that involved Upper Cook Inlet. The Cook Inlet, the Upper Cook Inlet Drift Association filed suit. The state intervened, and the point here was the Upper Cook Inlet wanted to preempt state management of salmon fisheries in Cook Inlet. State of Alaska, through Department of Fish and Game, requested intervention and requesting to exclusive management. A proposal is currently being worked through with the upcoming Board of Fish meeting, and federal agencies are also working with management plans. So we're optimistic that a that will get resolved amicably. So that takes us to the third core function of the Department of Law, and that's protecting fiscal integrity. Four sections of the department are involved. We have collections and support, oil and gas and mining, labor and state affairs, torts and worker compensation. The collections and support collects criminal fines and surcharges owed to the state and restitution owed to third parties. We collected $7.3 million in fiscal year 10, of which $1.1 million was for victim restitution. This next slide, which is the pie chart, shows you the different components of that. And it includes such things as adult restitution, juvenile restitution, cost of imprisonment, minor offenses, those sorts of things. So the combination of that was roughly $7.3 million that was collected through that. Oil, gas, and mining section. This is oil, gas royalties, taxes, so far in F2010, we collected roughly $82 million, and FY11 we're at $95.9 million through February.
Mr. Chair.
Senator French. Sorry, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. We had testimony in Senate Resources Committee that we are blowing the statute of limitations virtually every day on our some of our royalty cases because we don't have the computer equipment, we don't have the proper auditing equipment or databases. And because of that, we're just bypassing the time frame when we can file our lawsuits. Is that something you're aware of? Is that something you're looking into? Is that something that you have suggestions on how we can remedy, or is that a DNR issue?
Yeah, through the chair, I'm unaware that we are blowing statute of limitations. Certainly, I've just made a note. We will evaluate it. Tita Kobayashi is the head of the oil and gas section. I will be meeting with Tina shortly, and she's giving a presentation, I believe, tomorrow. So that's something that I can touch base with her on it, but I was unaware of that. I know that we have a number of ongoing litigations that go back 2006.
And I don't know that it's a Department of Law issue as much as it's a Department of Natural Resources issue. But
thank you for bringing it to my attention.
Senator Pasquin.
Thank you. Yes, and following up on Senator Wilikowski's, as I understand, as presented in the Resources Committee, that the audits have not been conducted, so they don't know whether there is monies owed, and then they are older than 6 years old, therefore they're out of the statute of limitations. And then the question is whether you continue to conduct an audit of something that's past its statute of limitations if at the end of the audit you have no capacity to do anything about it, other than in the general context that if an audit is completed, the state generally seeks and recovers additional monies. So there is an internal issue there that I think bears emphasis.
Okay. Well, thank you. I will. We will certainly address that. This is, I think, a very telling slide. It will show you, it reflects that since FY 2000 through 2010, the oil and gas section has recovered $1.95 billion. And that's a combination of tariffs, royalties, taxes, and non-oil and gas tax, which would be property related. This the next slide reflects that through February 8th, 2011, so far there's a recovery of 95, and it shows the breakdown.
Do we lose some, or do we only win?
Pardon me?
Do we lose some of these litigations, and this is the balance, the wins minus the losses?
I guess it's not so much. I'm unaware of any that we have lost wholesale. I know that we oftentimes will assert that there is a significantly larger amount that's owed, and this often is the net result of it. And so a lot of these actually are settled. The vast majority, my understanding, are settled.
I recall a big one in the past on the pipeline tariff being overcharged.
but we could only go back a certain number of years, and we had to give up all of the overcharges that were previous to that. But we did prevail. Had we filed years earlier, then it would have gone back that number of years again. So are we kind of not spending the dollar to make $10, or are we doing it the most efficient way? That's really, and I know you can't answer that right now, but that's really something I think that the committee would probably be curious about.
Mr. Chair, I think that's consistent with the comments of both Senator Wilikowski and Pascavan. It's an issue that needs to be evaluated, because if we are losing money, that we need to quickly correct that issue.
And the reason it's brought up, you probably can't just use the existing staff and add all this additional work. So my guess is, if indeed you discover that there might be a benefit in adding additional attorneys to pursue lawsuits, that would come before us, and we would have to make that decision ourselves on adding that to your budget.
All right. Well, I will, as I indicated, I will be following up with our section to find out what the answers are on those issues.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the issues that I've been concerned with, I know I talked with you about it when we met, is this whole issue of producers of the leaseholders of our mining leases, our oil and gas leases, fully engaged in their duty to produce. And so that's been something that I have felt strongly about for a number of years. And has any undertaking been done to look at all of our lease holdings to ensure that they are actually being produced? We've heard reports that there are organizations buying up some of the rare earth mines, for instance, or trying to get a hold of those leases and then sitting on them. And in the oil and gas sphere as well, I would have that same concern about leaseholders who are sitting on the leases and not producing them.
Through the chair, Senator, I'm not certain as to whether DNR is reviewing the leases from that perspective. I would assume that they probably are. From Department of Law's perspective, at this juncture, we're not actively engaged in a review of a lease to determine whether or not somebody's actively engaged on it. I would assume that would be an issue of DNR. DNR probably is looking at it, although I can't answer that directly.
And just following the clock, we're about halfway in, okay. And you're probably running a little bit behind.
Well, I only have 74 slides, so I'm actually feeling pretty comfortable with it.
I was looking at the page number rather than the slide number. Sorry.
No problem. Following up on the oil and gas and mining TAPS tariff litigation is, that seems to be something that goes on a fairly regular basis. We are engaged in litigation now that involves the strategic reconfiguration case. That's currently before FERC and RCA, and the upshot of that is that when the oil companies sought to electrify, there was a budget that was an anticipated cost of I think it was $250 or $300 million. The cost has far exceeded that, and they have sought to roll it into the base, and we're challenging whether or not they did it in a prudent fashion, because the cost of that is multiples, hundreds of millions of dollars. So that's a case that's ongoing. There's an 8-week hearing before FERC and RCA scheduled for November of 2011. The property tax litigation, we've represented the department. We are representing the Department of Revenue at Superior Court. Relating to the 2000 TAPS property tax valuation, that's ongoing. The issue is now on appeal, and the determination of that could have significant financial ramifications to municipalities that are served Fairbanks, North Slope Borough, Valdez as well. The property tax gets rolled in. And so one offsets the other to a certain extent. But that's an ongoing litigation. And you can also see the next slide. There is also an 8-week trial scheduled for September 2011 regarding TAP's property tax litigation for the years 2007 through 2009. My understanding is that Tina Kobayashi is doing a presentation, I believe, tomorrow. I think it's to House Finance on what the issues are, that specific issues relative to oil and gas and how it affects that budget component. The commercial and fair business, labor and state affairs sections, cruise ship initiative, passenger tax, that was obviously an issue that the legislature was very, very involved in. The new law reduces tax to $34.50, and that was the result of there was some compromise settlement that was worked through, and that the lawsuit by the cruise ship industry was dismissed.
Let me ask you a question about that one, because I've always been a little puzzled by this. In addition to the reduction in the head tax, the state agreed to pay the head taxes in both Juneau and Ketchikan, amounting to about $15. So if we're paying Juneau and Ketchikan the $15, then we collected that from, we're using the head tax money to do that. But prior to that, that was an additional tax that the cruise ships companies paid. So in other words, they paid the $50 plus they paid a $15 local tax. So when we reduced the head tax by about $10, we also reduced it by a certain amount that we were now going to reimburse these two locations, Juneau and Ketchikan. And then we also agreed to pay so much per port of call. In the end, I thought maybe we had essentially wiped out the entire head tax. And it looked that way to me. In fact, it's conceivable we could have got ourselves in the hole by saying we're going to pay the first five ports of call, $5 each, that was 25, plus the 15 that we agreed to take on, plus the reduction in the head tax. And pretty soon, we had made a decision that essentially we were subsidizing cruise ships. And I didn't think we intended to do that, but we did. And it passed, and that's where we are today. Did you follow through all the arithmetic that we did when we passed that piece of legislation in the waning hours of the 26th legislative session?
Mr. Chair, I did not. I'm not familiar with the machinations of it. All I know is that the current tax is $34.50.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. I thought the state came out on the short end of the stick on that one as well, and it was a decision that was based on attorney's advice to settle the case, or a settlement that was recommended. And what did the state get out of this deal? What if we were supposed to get cruise ships coming back? I think one ship came back. Am I wrong? Did more come back? Are more coming back?
Through the chair, with due respect, I'm not in a position to answer that. That predates me. I mean, I'm certainly in a position to find out if you'd like to know how many cruise ships came back, but I couldn't tell you sitting here.
Mr. Chair, I'd be curious, because we gave back tens of millions of dollars, and this was an exchange for us agreeing to settle this lawsuit, and we were supposed to get something out of it, and there's never been a follow-up as far as to me anyway, about what we got.
Yeah, I'm not in a position to answer that now, but I could certainly look into it further if you would like. Make a note of that. Labor and State Affairs, we talked on this earlier, the lawsuit against Mercer, the actuary for the state pension plans. I think you probably all are well aware of the basis and the genesis of that lawsuit. That actually ended up, as you're aware, settling. Mercer paid $500 million. This is the Carlson matter. Is I know an issue of some contention within the legislature. The The result of that was it settled a decision by the court, 26-year-old lawsuit by non-resident fishermen. The court issued a judgment. The principal amount of that judgment was $12 million. Adding up all of the interest, attorney fees, and that was significantly more money. That all has been funded. That is sitting in the court registry. What is on appeal is the amount of prejudgment interest, which was the court had issued it at 11%, and also the amount of the attorney fees. That's on appeal. Depending on the results of that appeal, it could be a savings of up to $60 million to the state. The money, the judgment is fully funded, and it just awaits a final determination by the court as to what the appropriate interest rate is.
Senator Passben?
Yes, is that the $60 million, is that addressing a difference between, for example, 3.5% interest and 11% interest?
Yes, and the amount of the attorney fees that were calculated on the full amount.
Right, because that's attorney's exactly. fees, yes. if I may, through the attorney's fees are calculated on the cumulative principal and interest, and so that it's both compounded.
But it is pretty clear that can charge out-of-state fishing boats a different tax than in-state boats. And when we did that, did we ever, well, did we question the legality of doing that, or did we just do it?
No, Mr. Chair, I'm not in a position to answer that. All I know is that it was ongoing for virtually 26 years, and the court, as you noted, found it was improper. The judgment was $12 million principal, and added to it all of the interest. Now, then the other thing, not only is the interest 11%, but it's compounded quarterly, and so it's an astronomical amount of interest, and so that issue is the focus of the appeal. The transportation section is handling two litigation involving two fast ferries, the Fairweather and the Chenega. Unfortunately, efforts to resolve this have been unsuccessful. We needed to file litigation to preserve the statute of limitations. Fairweather is currently out of service. The Chenega is hopefully will continue on, but this is one of those instances where it certainly did not live up to what was represented. So we're optimistic that settlement discussions will prove fruitful, but if not, we will we file the litigation, and we're moving forward with that.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Attorney General Burns, are those ferries, or if they had been operating, would those ferries have made money for the state?
Couldn't answer that question. I don't know. I don't know if you're going to the damage component of it.
That's right. What's called consequential damages. Yep.
What that's through the chair. What the state is most focused on is a fix to the ferries. Getting those ferries fixed, because the life of the ferries with the current engines are significantly reduced. It's less an issue of damages as it is to getting a proper warranty and getting both those ferries fixed. So I don't know that whether or not we are pursuing a damage component, other than what we are asking for is that those vessels be what was warranted.
Actually, may I?
Go ahead.
But speaking not just as a member of the body here, but as a lawyer, I would hope you're looking for all the damages you could collect. I mean, and if not, I would like to know why not.
Yeah, it is a component. I can assure you it's a component of the damage claim.
Senator French?
My co-chair and I were discussing your point, Representative, and we're afraid that we're actually saving money by having the ferry and dock, and that if we made lots of money on ferries, there'd probably be more of them. So certainly do your research.
To the chair, I assume that would be an offset for the damages on their part. There's no damages. In fact, you're making money. You owe us.
Well, my understanding.
Whose side are you on, Representative?
my understanding is our, it's called cash box return, is about 35 cents, which means that that's what we collect for every dollar that we spend to operate them. So Senator French makes a good point that we keep saving the dollar and giving up the 35 cents.
Maybe we should turn this into a class action.
To the chair, all I know is that these ferries are not living up to what was represented, regardless of the return on whether or not we're making money on them. The last slide regarding protecting fiscal integrity is kind of along the same lines of the child in need of aid slide that I had previously shown. This slide reflects that in addition to you know, oil and gas, the return on investment, that sort of thing. The Department of Law successfully defended over 200 tort claims with no adverse judgments against the state. Now, most of those were settled, but what this slide, what's significant about this is, you know, two things. First, obviously, the Department of Law is doing a good job in handling those cases, but more importantly, is that the other departments, Department of Corrections, for example, it's doing their job very, very well. In the past, there were significant judgments that were issued or large settlements. This speaks to the fact that there is good communication between the Department of Law and the agencies. The agencies are doing a good job in what they do. So it's Department of Corrections, Office of Child Services, the other agencies that that have historically been you know, been named defendants.
While you're talking about corrections, in talking to the commissioner and looking at some of the data that's there, we are when we have a prisoner, we're obligated to take care of all their medical costs. And a high-end prisoner is forget names, but dialysis and $500,000 a year. Now, if we had a high-end prisoner costing us $500,000 a year, and we released the prisoner, would we still be obligated, because we had begun the care for a prisoner, to continue with the care? Or when the prisoner is released, does that release us from our obligation of medical care also?
I will look into it if the chair would like, but my assessment of that would be that, you know, once the individual is released, there's no ongoing obligation to provide services. You're obligated during the tenure of the incarceration, but beyond that, there would be no continuing obligation.
Okay. Thank you.
And the fourth core service is promoting good governance. The three sections of the Department of Law that handle those, natural resources, opinion and appeals, labor, and state affairs. You're all very familiar with the recent federal election, in which there were a number of issues that the Department of Law was involved with, not just the litigation themselves. I mean, there was a series of litigations, also public records lawsuits, that sort of thing. There were, as a result of it, the Department of Law was very instrumental and heavily involved in that process. And I know that there are a number of bills winnowing their way through the legislature to address some of those issues that came up in that last election. Slide 61 reflects that there was some litigation involving NIC versus state that was defended and settled. It was an election lawsuit in Western Alaska. The result of that is that there have been some enhancements to language assistance for Yupik-speaking voters available in the Bethel area. Opinions and appeals have defended the initiative process. They're defending it currently in connection with the Planned Parenthood matter. Just recently, in the Natural Right to Life, there was an initiative that was proposed. Those are instances where the opinions and appeals section has been involved. Executive Branch Ethics Act. I think Representative Gruenberg had a similar bill, House Bill 14. This is, they were adopted new regulations, including standards governing state reimbursement of attorney fees incurred by state officers that were exonerated in an Ethics Act complaint proceeding. We've given ethics training for senior managers and boards, and we serve advisory opinions in investigations. This is the next slide reflects the burgeoning public records request, the issues that have had to be dealt with in Department of Law and that. There's currently roughly 26,000 pages of emails that have going through the process. The definitive date for production is to the governor's office is May 31st. In addition to that, the Department of Law had to address 43 separate public records requests that were directed to law, and the process obviously is to go through to do privilege reviews, deliberative protections, that sort of thing. So that that's where we are. Okay, that shows the successes of the past year, the challenges of 2012 remain essentially the same. We continue, the Department of Law continues to focus on the mission and the core objectives. We will continue to do that as we always have. On top of that, or in addition to that, much has been, there is, as some of the earlier slides reflected, a number of increasing, there's an increasing litigation and involvement with the federal government related to natural resource development. And it's not simply in the litigation component of it. As the agencies, BLM, EPA, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, ESA, these sorts of issues continue to percolate, it's a clear recognition that the state of Alaska has to be engaged early and upfront in dialoguing and trying to address the issues and being involved in the public process as opposed to litigating. The litigation is truly an issue of last resort. It has obviously had to be used, and when it's necessary, it will be used. But the hope is that we can dialogue and be involved in this process early on. And so we continue to work with Fish and Game, DNR, other constituent groups or stakeholders. As I noted, I had been up to Barrow twice now, most recently Thursday last week to meet with the mayor and Arctic Slope Regional Corporation to address how do we collectively work these issues, move these issues forward, because there's a clear recognition that responsible development is necessary, and the last thing we want to do is to be constantly adverse to the federal government. And there's been a misperception that the state of Alaska is anti-federal government. And that really is a misperception, because it's got to be a very symbiotic relationship. We are critically dependent on one another for various on various issues, strategically, military bases, the resource that's available needs to be tapped in. The concern really has come from the standpoint that there is some uncertainty as to what the federal government's objective is as it relates to natural resource development. And I say that from the standpoint that, the uncertainty on what the federal government's policy is creates uncertainty within the arena of development generally. And I say that because just looking at certain issues, BLM is involved, as I noted earlier, the planning process, the NPRA, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the ANWR Coastal Plain Study that could lead to a recommendation of wilderness designation, which if that's done would effectively preclude development. BLM's recent notice of wetlands and wilderness policy for evaluating the various lands under its management could have impact. The federal government's new ocean policy, the new ocean zoning and possible incursion into what was traditionally state water resource management. Likewise, the federal policy on Tongass Force seems to be changing. The reality is that the federal government owns 60% of the land in the state of Alaska. Most of what they are doing affects federal lands. All right, and so do they have the right to do what they're doing? Yes. Okay, they do. It's their land. All right, but we, as the state of Alaska, also have a significant interest because of a revenue sharing that we receive when resources are developed. On top of that, though, in the nearly 105 million acres, I think it is, that the state of Alaska received in conjunction with statehood, the Statehood Act, the federal government's permitting policies are having an impact on our ability to develop those resources. We talked about EPA, for example. That's a significant issue on the 404C designation. But I want to emphasize on slide 67, for example. The point is that the state of Alaska has worked very closely, and we continue to try to work very closely with the federal government. It is not always adversarial, right? And it should not be. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to maximize those opportunities to work together, and hopefully in the process of dialoguing and early involvement when we deal with ESA issues, for example, early involvement scientifically, good science, benefiting good science, engage proactively. But these are examples of where there is a good cooperative working relationship. DEC, Air Permitting Program, DEC, Assumption of National Pollutant Discharge Elimination Systems, the cleanup, federal cleanup. Okay, these are areas where the DEC has manages the programs. The Clean Air Act, unfortunately, in that one, DEC has primacy over all air permitting for facility and construction operation, with the exception of OCS. Okay, that's the EPA retains that. On the next slide, slide 68, we talked about these areas where, again, very positive, cooperative working relationship had significant benefit to the state of Alaska. Kensington Mine, Red Dog, the logjam timber sale in the U.S. Forest Service, Outer Continental Shelf challenges. Okay. Working cooperatively with the federal government had tremendous successes. But there are challenges. As reflected on slide 69, the Endangered Species Act has created major consternation. The designation of critical habitat, encompassing 187,000 square miles of habitat. The Clean Water Act, the effect on CD5, also Tanana River Bridge is another example where the EPA has weighed in on that. Clean Air Act, we all know the issue on Shell and the Beaufort Sea. Wilderness wildland designations, those are areas where there is a challenge that's ongoing. How do we deal with those challenges? We continue to support, as legally appropriate, responsible resource development by developing a comprehensive plan to address these issues, like the Endangered Species Act. We are working with other agencies to develop a long-range, five-year interdepartmental plan to address a lot of these things, because no department can do it, deal with these issues by themselves. Fish and Game has to have the resources and the backup, Department of Law, to engage early on. And Department of Law has to work with DNR and ADF&G in trying to facilitate what the appropriate regulations ought to be. On top of that, what we've got to do is we've got to dialogue and collaborate with tribes and Native organizations, other attorney generals in other states, those sorts of things. And that's what we are doing, is to work through a comprehensive plan to address these issues. So that brings us to where we hope to be in 2012 and looking forward. So I'm open to any questions.
Yeah.
I've written down a number of notes that we have follow-up on.
I had, beginning in 2003, I'd heard a lot of conversation about 2477 access. I'm not sure how that has evolved by now or 2011, looking even further ahead. Is that essentially different than what it was in 2003?
I don't know how to answer that question since I wasn't part of it in 2003. What I can tell you, though, is that the Department of Law, working with DNR, is working to evaluate the 2477, because what the federal government has effectively said is that we are not going to acknowledge 2477s unless you can prove every step of the every step of that process. And so what the state of Alaska has to do is identify those areas that qualify for 2477 and effectively prioritize them, both in the context of what resources are we going to develop access, right? Not just to have a 2477 access road to nowhere, but how do we prioritize the benefit of that, and also prioritize from the standpoint of success. There's no sense spending huge amounts of money on a 2477 if there's no probability of proving up on it. And so DNR and DOL are working together to try to prioritize those issues.
Okay, and I noticed on slide 63, Representative Gruenberg's name showed up on the HB 14, and that's probably not your question now, but you do have a question now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I have been interested for some time in a lawsuit that's progressing. It first progressed through the federal district court in New Jersey, and an adverse result came from that district court judge, and now there's a possibility of commencing litigation in a different venue to see about getting a different result. It's a claim by a number of states for World War II bonds, millions of dollars in unclaimed war bonds remain outstanding because the federal government, according to the claim, neglected to notify owners of the bonds that they had bonds. It's like when we were babies or young folks, people would have given us bonds and they were never cashed because people didn't have any notice of this. And this is worth millions and millions of dollars nationally. And a group of states, through their AGs, have bonded together, bad term, joined together try to reclaim these. A federal district court judge one of the districts in New Jersey came out with a decision I personally did not think was a very strong decision. And I know that's being appealed. We didn't join that, nor did some other states. And Chris Pogue has been working on this through your department and looking at seeing potentially commencing a new lawsuit. And there are like four different jurisdictions they could do that in, one of them being Alaska. At this point, they hadn't, at least last time I talked to Chris, hadn't decided which jurisdiction, if any, to do that in. And I'm wondering if there's been any progress. I don't need an answer now, but I think, if I may suggest to the committee, if you could get us that in writing. It's worth a lot of money to a lot of Americans.
Through the chair, I understand that it continues to be evaluated. My understanding is no decision has been made, but that it will be evaluated further, and I will get a response.
Through the chair, I appreciate the administration's willingness to pursue that on behalf of all the Alaskans and other Americans who are not getting their money that they're really owed.
Thank you. Further questions? It's an overview, but if someone in the audience has a question, I will entertain that. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. And another, since I'm sort of on a soapbox here, small. I've been working also with Mr. Pogue to deal with the fact that right now there's no follow-up when people get grants and they get into trouble with the administration of those grants, and some people take advantage of our grantees. And I appreciate the Department of Laws being involved in that. It involves some of our constituents, Senator Wilkowski and my. But the problem is more than that, because there's no statutory mechanism for the state following up to make sure that our grantees, some of whom are not very sophisticated, are not ripped off. And I'd just like to commend again you folks and Mr. Pogan, like to work with you on that to protect our grantees.
Thank you.
Senator Pascvan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the issues on interdepartmental cooperation, and again focusing upon these issues of statute of limitations, we provide capital credits for capital expenditures, and the question is what are the what is being deducted as a capital expenditure for purposes of receiving that 20% capital credit. So I think that it's important for the state in its analysis of the statute of limitations issue to make sure that we find out exactly what is classified as a capital expenditure, and it's a significant issue right now as far as we don't know. Okay. There's billions of dollars being spent as capital expenditures, and we don't know whether they're for ordinary maintenance.
Okay. Further questions? Seeing and hearing none. Mr. Attorney General.
Thank you very much for the
so
time.
Much for coming here with your extensive slide presentation.
You made it.
With that, we are adjourned.